Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers, particularly Bill Tracy and Tommy, for inviting Bioversity International to make this presentation on the global perspective of genetic vulnerability. Really, it's Toby Hodgkin that should have been here, but he's the director of our global partnership program. Unfortunately, he's taken up and cannot make it, so I took the opportunity of coming and making his presentation. Right, so...
Can you hear
Sean
okay?
Is that okay?
Can you hear
I know I have a very soft voice, so I try and call closer to the mic. Right. Yeah, so this is the overview of the presentation. I'm going just to talk a little bit about what we mean by genetic vulnerability and discuss a little bit its importance to the global food security issues worldwide, present some very general case studies, and then conclude with some few key questions and future directions. Now, we view genetic vulnerability as the condition that results when a widely planted crop is uniformly susceptible to a pest, pathogen, or environmental hazard as a result of its genetic constitution, thereby creating a potential for widespread crop losses. Now, this is a definition, as was said by our previous speaker, from the National Research Council in 1972, which was also reported in the State of the World Report on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, published by FAO. It is important to note that this definition addresses the vulnerability of loss of genetic resources, an aspect of genetic erosion, and also a potential for production loss, which is usually due to abiotic stresses. It is likely also that vulnerability increases as uniformity increases, as was discussed by previous speakers already. Now, in the global context, the phenomenon of genetic vulnerability has major impacts, I think, on the capacity of our agricultural system to ensure food security in a sustainable manner, and also in sustaining people's livelihood, particularly in developing world. The problem of genetic vulnerability has been duly recognized in some of the major initiatives in agriculture worldwide. The first State of the World report on PGRFA, Plant Genetic Resources for Food Agriculture, highlighted genetic vulnerability as one of the major threats to crop failures and described the major causes as being due to widespread replacement and of genetically diverse traditional farmers' varieties by homogeneous modern varieties. In assessing its degree of vulnerability, there are two factors which are of great concern. As was said before, these are the relative area which are devoted to particular modern varieties and also to the degree of uniformity. Now, the accompanying Global Plan of Action to the State of the World report proposed a number of activities to increase the use of genetic diversity in the field and to reduce crop vulnerability. These are to monitor genetic uniformity and crop vulnerability, to review policies that affect diversity in the field, to promote the increase of the use of varietal mixtures, to improve the deployment of genetic diversity as part of strategies for integrated pest management, and to promote decentralized and participatory plant breeding strategies. Now, the other important global initiative is the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food Agriculture. This is yet another very important global instrument that was adopted by FAO conference in November 2001. This is a legally binding treaty and which covers all plant genetic resources relevant to food and agriculture, and has been designed to be in harmony with the Convention on Biological Diversity. I think the treaty is vital in ensuring the continued availability of plant genetic resources that countries will need to feed their people. The treaty calls for the conservation and sustainable use of PGRFA and the fair and equitable sharing of benefits derived from its use. It establishes a multilateral system to facilitate the access and the benefit sharing. This applies to 64 crops of major importance for food security, which is listed in Annex 1 of the treaty. And this has, as I said, been established according to criteria of food security and interdependence, as well as crops held in ex situ collections of the CGIAR centres as part of Annex 15. The governing body of the treaty has also ratified a standard material transfer agreement in order to facilitate germplasm exchange so as to increase the use of that globally. Only last week there was the second session of the governing body of the treaty, whereby they were also trying to discuss on a standard material agreement for non-Annex 1 species, for which there has not been any agreement yet so far, so it's not under the treaty. Now, in the context of genetic vulnerability, Article 6 of the treaty calls for measures to be taken by contracting parties to develop and maintain appropriate policies and legal measures that promote sustainable use of PGRFA. In particular, Article 6.2F calls for the wider use of diversity and the creation of strong links to plant breeding and agricultural development in order to reduce crop vulnerability and genetic erosion. There are a number of examples of genetic vulnerability, and we've already heard about some of those in the earlier presentation. And most of those examples are based on the problem of genetic uniformity. The most famous example, as you would know, is the potato famine of 1845 to 1848, when a pandemic of the potato late blight wiped out the potato crop in Europe and North America. And also there was another outbreak of a new race of the fungus in the 1980s, which hit Europe, Asia, and Latin America. Now, the case of the new race of maize leaf blight in the 1970s, as you know, destroyed more than 15% of the US maize crop as a result of the same cytoplasmic genes used in the breeding of all major varieties. This led the US National Research Council to recommend the diversification of the genetic base of major crops. Banana is another example of genetic uniformity. It is derived from one original banana variety, the Cavendish, and all are highly susceptible to the fungal disease Black Sigatoka, first described in the Sigatoka Valley in Fiji in 1963. There are many more examples from the US. The bean Phaseolus vulgaris, we heard the case of Prunus from our previous speaker. The apple from the US, as we know, two cultivars account for more than 50% of the entire apple crop in the US. There are cases of the wheat in Bangladesh, India and Mexico, the case of rice in West Africa, Korea and China, so I won't have time to go in all these examples, but I would like to focus on three major case studies. The first is the one which Norman Borlaug mentioned yesterday in his seminal talk yesterday, the wheat stem rust, which is caused by the fungus Pusina graminis subspecies Trichichi. It occurs worldwide wherever wheat grows. It can lead to severe crop losses, as much as 70% over large areas, and individual fields can be totally destroyed. Now, symptoms are produced on almost all aerial parts of the wheat plant, it is first seen as elongated elliptical blisters on the leaves and stem of the plant, which then breaks open some days later to reveal a mass of rust-colored spores. The disease causes straw breakage, resulting in the loss of spikes with combined harvesting. Now, as Norman Borlaug mentioned yesterday, in the 1950s, scientists from a consortium of universities, really research funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, with scientists from the CGIAR centers, CIMIT, ICARDA, and others, worked very hard to develop resistant wheat varieties with the introduction of the resistance gene SR2 complex. In the 1960s, other alien resistant genes such as SR24, 26, and 31 were also deployed worldwide, to the extent that it was thought that the fungus was beaten for good. But we know in 1999, a new race of the stem rust with virulence to the SR31 was detected in Uganda, even though that the stem rust resistance in wheat cultivar with SR31 has been really very effective and durable worldwide for more than 30 years. From Uganda, when it was first detected, it was observed in Kenya in 2001, and then it appeared in Ethiopia in 2003. In January 2007, the spore had crossed over the Red Sea into Yemen. UG99 constitute a real threat to wheat cultivation in this part of the world. So far, 90% of the wheat lines tested are susceptible to UG99. It is indeed really a scary thought to think that spores could easily reach India and Pakistan, either through the Middle East, the red arrows here, or across the Indian Ocean, the blue arrows, to reach India and Pakistan. I would like to stress that 44% of all the wheat area are found in this region of the world, with 62 million hectares located just in three countries, India, Pakistan, and China. Now, it is not just how fast this disease is spreading that matters, but the impact that it can have on farmers' livelihood. I think the point here is that the wheat stem rust case demonstrates how vulnerable uniformity can be and the impacts it can have on farmers' livelihood, particularly in those developing countries who do not have access to risk mitigation strategies available to them as farmers have in the northern developing world. The other case I'd like to present is that of the napier grass, Penicetum purpureum, which is native in East Africa. It is a tall grass, mainly propagated by cuttings. I think this is a very important point, because the crop is disseminated as a clone over quite large areas. Native grass is widely used in East Africa as a cut and carry fodder crop because of its high yield, and this plays a very important role in the dairy sector. Most farmers practice zero grazing by growing Napier grass, and they cut and carry the fodder to animals in their stalls. The grass, however, is threatened by disease caused by phytoplasma. The disease reduces plant growth, the shoots become thinner and yellowish. Other symptoms include proliferation of tillers, shorter internodes, lower biomass, which obviously impacts productivity quite largely. According to Jones et al., the disease first appeared in Kenya in the year 2000. The Namulonge Agricultural and Animal Production Research Institute in Uganda observed symptoms of the disease in 2001. And more recently, the napier grass was seen reported also in in Ethiopia. The fact that napier grass is propagated and distributed by cuttings increases the risk of spreading the disease. Also, plantations are bound to become uniform genetically and be much vulnerable to attacks by the disease. Taro colocasia esculenta is a tropical plant grown primarily as a vegetable food for its edible core, and secondarily as a leafy vegetable. The plant is susceptible to the leaf blight caused by the fungus Phytophthora colocasia. The disease reduces the number of functional leaves, and can lead to more than 50% yield reduction. The fungus has been widespread in many of the Pacific islands, like the American Samoa, Micronesia, Guam, Hawaii, Samoa, Solomon Islands, etc. The most recent introduction of the disease was to the Samoan Islands in 1993. In Samoa, taro was a very important cash crop for farmers, and over 90% of the household were growing the crop, and mostly one variety, in particular the Nui variety. However, with the outbreak of the disease, all taro varieties, especially the variety Nui, were severely affected due to the large area planted and uniformity of the crop. Samoa overnight lost an export market worth around $4 million per year, with similar decline in domestic supplies. The blight destroyed the whole crop industry, and people abandoned taro cultivation and shifted to planting sweet potatoes instead. So the impact of this blight led to the development of Tarogen, the Taro Genetic Resources Conservation and Utilization, which is a regional project set up to discuss disease control, the loss of genetic resources, and to look for ways to prevent the further spread of the disease through development of improved lines and resistant varieties. Now, the recent introduction of TLB to Samoa clearly illustrates the devastation that this blight can cause and highlight the vulnerability, particularly of isolated taro population that for years evolved in the case of the disease. This is particularly so for, you know, insular countries like many of these Pacific Island countries. I would like now to discuss a few key questions relating to genetic vulnerability. These are some of the thoughts that Toby has asked me to present to you for discussion. The first question is that, are the effects of genetic vulnerability different in developed and developing countries? I think it is a fact that farmers are generally not concerned that intensive or continuous cultivation of uniform crop varieties increase the risk of vulnerability until production is actually affected. If an epidemic arises, they can depend on plant breeders to supply new varieties. This is the case in industrialized countries, but what is it for the farmers in developing countries? The situation is very different. They would not have access to compensation, to insurance, as was illustrated in the case of, the Prunus. Thus, developing countries are at a much higher risk than more industrial countries. The second question, is the degree of vulnerability significant in different crops? One could argue that new varieties of annual crops can be easily provided within a few years of breeding, but the same cannot be said for perennial crops. Many years of breeding are needed to obtain new resistant varieties. Perhaps with the advance of biotechnology, this can be speeded up, but how fast? Fruit crops are particularly vulnerable to epidemics because many of the chemicals used to avoid disease, many of which have been removed from the market. So these create additional problems. The final question is, are there different types of vulnerability? In our definition of genetic vulnerability, we alluded to the susceptibility of crops to pests, pathogens, environmental hazards as a result of its genetic constitution. Thus, genetic uniformity to crops may render them susceptible to pests and disease. Changes may also happen within the genetic constitution of pest organisms themselves, which makes them become more virulent and overcomes resistance of modern crop varieties, the so-called mutational vulnerability, as was in the case in the UG99. With climate change becoming a reality, crop varieties are also becoming more vulnerable. The more restricted are the ecological niches, the more vulnerable they are to climate change, as was really very effectively shown by Carrie earlier in his talk. So, to conclude, a few points for future consideration. Now, despite the fact that history has provided many cases demonstrating genetic vulnerability, there are no comprehensive data with which to measure changes in crop vulnerability over time. We still do not have any means to assess the degree of genetic change over time, the genetic erosion which is happening, the genetic vulnerability, or calculating the probability that an epidemic of pests and diseases will happen in the near future. We need to develop coping strategies to mitigate the risk of crop failures arising from genetic vulnerability. We need a sort of a framework or contingency plan to handle vulnerability in cases something happens. The international treaty provides this international framework for promoting activities that will help reduce crop vulnerability, in particular the Article 6.2 A to G, which provides certain specific suggestions to research to maximize use of diversity, plant breeding with participation of farmers, broadening genetic bases, promoting local crops and neglected and underutilized species, supporting the wider use of diversity on farm, and developing better breeding strategies and seed regulations. The susceptibility of diseases is a natural phenomenon, characteristic to all plants. The only way it can be reduced in agricultural system is to promote a greater diversity of crops and land races in the field. With this slide, I'd like to thank you for your attention. I think that when we speak of genetic vulnerability in the world, it is the lives of these children that which are at stake. They are the most vulnerable of our society, so we need to make sure that our crops are stable to be able to feed those who are hungry. Thank you very much.